The title song from a 1974 album by Steely Dan, Pretzel Logic. That's a great song. A little bit about time travel. You ever read what that tune is supposed to be about? We're talking with Joshua Cutchin about his book, The Brimstone Deceit. All kinds of smells that pop up in paranormal and supernatural phenomena. And we barely scratched the surface. One of the topics I want to touch on in the next segment is about cats and dogs. They seem to have obviously they have a much more refined sense of smell than we humans do, which suggests maybe they can be used as sort of biosensors. I know a place where that's actually happened in practice. We'll get into that and some other smells about associated with good spirits and a lot more in this next segment of Coast to Coast AM. Josh Cutchin, in the book, The Brimstone Deceit, you mention a couple of places where, folks invoke smells. They use smells as a tool to connect to something supernatural, mystics or mediums or priests.
Yes, there was actually a really fascinating encounter by a gentleman named Walter Ritzy, who was traveling through the Dolomite Mountains in the summer of 1968. And he had pulled off the side of the road to catch a couple of winks, and he actually awoke with this strong odor that smelled like something was burning. He actually thought his car was on fire at the time. He perceived this bright light in the distance, and this entire encounter made him recall back when he was a younger man in 1942. He was on the Greek island of Rhodes, and he used to take food to a holy man. And after a while, he developed a relationship with this holy man, and this holy man told him, according to this Walter Ritzy gentleman, that he would be able to discern, after the holy man passed away, his presence, because it would be a powerful odor of roses and lily of the valley. And interestingly enough, the way that this sort of coincides with the UFO angle is this holy man had told Ritzy that eventually one day he would meet people from outside of our world, and that was that event that he encountered in the Dolomite Mountains. So it's interesting. You'll find not only that, but you also find saints in a lot of more orthodox traditions would make their presence known by the smell of wonderful florid odors as well.
And Mary,
yes,
Fatima.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's interesting because if you look at the smells accompanied by the Blessed Virgin Mary apparitions, they often are a sort of floral nature, not that dissimilar from what you find in female ghost encounters. There was a famous apparition, Our Lady of Laos, L-A-U-S, France, which is a Marian apparition that is completely centered around a smell. This young shepherd lady, was tending to her flock when she encountered this beautiful woman who she perceived to be the Virgin Mary, who smelled of some sort of floral perfume, and she said, "Go into the town and find a building that smells like I do of this floral perfume, and that's where you should be. That's where you should set up your mission." Now, of course, what's interesting to me is sort of a Fortean is how these descriptions of these Marian apparitions look a lot like the same descriptions that you see in early contactee reports. For example, Orfeo Angelucci, a famous contactee from the 50s, encountered a beautiful lady from space whose presence would always be signified by the smell of flower scents upon the breeze.
I was mentioning about the priests, for example, using incense in the early days of the church. Maybe they still do, I guess, in part to perhaps cover up something bad that was a smelling, but also in the same way that some mystics and mediums use it as a way to bridge the gap, to connect with the other world or something.
No, absolutely. So the commonly held idea is that incense was used to cover up all the sort of smells you run into in the early church, the smells of body odor, or the smells of having that many people stuffed in one space. But also, really, it can be seen as sort of a variation on a burnt offering, because instead of burning flesh, as you would have in the Old Testament, you're burning instead essential oils and vegetative matter in the form of incense. So it is about sort of bridging that gap, very similar to the concepts that you find of people leaving out offerings for entities and the essence of those offerings being taken.
And, there are folks who use smudge pots or something to clean out a house that's haunted. I can't remember if you touch on that in the book or not, but there are those who will swear by that.
There are several schools of thought. Sort of the Hollywood version is to smudge the house with sage. Although I found in my research, I don't think any of this really made it into the book. Some of my research pointed to the fact that perhaps frankincense and dragon's blood are just as effective in terms of cleaning a house.
You have a story about the biggest house in America, the Biltmore House. And you make the point that people can report something that turns out to be historically inaccurate, but they're not necessarily wrong. Explain that and tell the story of that house.
Oh, well, this is an idea that I've talked with several friends of mine, including Greg Bishop, about this idea of co-creation in terms of what our expectations sort of bring to these encounters. So in the case of Vanderbilt, George Washington Vanderbilt, an old tycoon from long ago, built the nation's largest privately owned house, the Biltmore House, in Asheville, North Carolina. And people nowadays report seeing a gentleman that they believe is Vanderbilt, who fits Vanderbilt's description, smoking a pipe, which is a fine ghost story, except for the problem that in his life, Vanderbilt neither drank nor smoked. He was described by some as being a red-hot prohibitionist. Now, I certainly don't think that everyone is lying, and they might be misidentifying the ghost of someone else with Vanderbilt. But I have to wonder, you know, if you go to Biltmore House, it definitely looks like it should be haunted. I mean, it looks like the setting of that wonderful 1960s film, The Haunting, in a lot of ways. It's very gothic and very large and imposing. So we almost think that places like Biltmore House are supposed to be haunted. So I wonder what might happen if someone happens to have some sort of smell suggested to them. They might sort of graft a narrative onto it that fits with the location that they're at, or something that I personally hold is that perhaps there are intelligences that are aware of our expectations and decide to, again, manipulate those expectations into a setting that might be appropriate and one that might really resonate with the witness.
Ah, or Vanderbilt started smoking after he passed over the other side.
Not a bad idea. You can avoid all the health problems that way.
Let's talk about cats and dogs. You touch on this a couple of points in the book, and it's of interest to me. I'm broadcasting from a location that's absolutely infested with cats. And anybody who's been around animals, you know that they can sense things that we can't sense. They see things. I don't know if they're just messing with our heads. They look at a door or a wall as if to suggest that something is there. But they also smell things before we humans can smell them, and you make that point in the book.
Yes, it's really sort of fascinating to me. Some people suspect, well, the science, again, is sort of dodgy on this. The amount to which animals have a better sense than we do is still not entirely pinned down, but most researchers agree that, for example, a cat's sense of smell is about 14 to 15 times greater than that of a human, but dog noses, on the other hand, are 10 to 100,000 times as acute. I read some research from an individual, a sensory research individual at Florida State, and he said that, you know, suppose that the smell of a dog is just 10,000 times better than the human sense of smell. If you draw that comparison over to vision, then what we can see at a third of a mile, a dog could see at 3,000 miles away. So it's extremely acute. So I wonder if perhaps all paranormal phenomena don't smell to some degree, because humans have a certain threshold below which they cannot detect certain smells. And it varies from smell to smell, but there's always a threshold below which smells exist, but we can't detect them. But pets, like cats and dogs, definitely would be able to. So sometimes I wonder if perhaps all paranormal phenomena manifest some sort of minute odor. And when we have our pets that look to the door or something, they're actually smelling something that we aren't smelling, as opposed to seeing something we aren't seeing.
I alluded to this a little bit earlier in this hour about the use of dogs as biosensors, and that really did happen at the Skinwalker Ranch, the ranch in Utah. The Bigelow Organization, NIDS, they camped out on that property for more than 7 years to investigate a range of paranormal activity, and they got rescue dogs that they used. They would take them out at night on the range and would rely on them to pick up on things before the humans could detect it, either sight or sound or smell, and it worked. They were like an alarm system,
which I think is a fascinating and very very astute way to use some something that's sort of out of the box thinking. If I recall correctly, you had experienced some anomalous odors there as well, didn't you?
I did not, but a lot of the people on the team did, and the people who lived on the property did. There were a number of really powerful, strange smells. The sulfur smell was pretty common, sometimes associated with something that was invisible, that would it would travel through water. They could see it displacing water, and they could smell it, but they couldn't see it. It would move among the livestock and disperse livestock and scatter them as if it was, they could feel it. But again, you couldn't see it, and you could certainly smell it. Yeah, it was pretty commonly detected there, and it was logged and investigated, but it only went so far. You know, they certainly noticed it, but hard to reach conclusions about something as weird as that.
Well, and that's true. And something that I find really interesting about, you know, a lot of the cases at the ranch is the way in which they combined a lot of different things that we tend to, as researchers, want to put into separate categories. And that's why I felt like it was probably a good idea to really take a look at the similarities between spirit smells and UFO smells and Bigfoot smells. But, you know, Skinwalker Ranch comes up there, too. You find tales of chupacabras that I write about in the book, where they smell like sulfur. Men in Black. I mean, really, I was surprised at how pervasive the smell of sulfur was. So it's interesting to hear that that was one of the more common smells on the ranch.
Yeah, I mean, well, Bigfoot, UFOs, ghosts, demons, all across the board, you've got sulfur smells, or the same similar smells with all of them. I wonder if you think it's jumping to too much of a conclusion to suggest that this implicates that there is some kind of connection between all these different phenomena.
Well, you know, that really is sort of where a lot of my interest in the paranormal lies, is in the shared qualities, which is one of the reasons that I wanted to sort of approach this looking mainly at ghosts, UFOs, and Sasquatch. I do think that at the very least it implies that there is some common method at play, if not a common source of these sort of apparitions and these sort of encounters. I think it implies that there's a common method at play. So I think that either we're seeing similar things using similar methods, or different things using similar methods, rather, or we're seeing the same different sides of the same thing, or, you know, at the end of the day, we might be seeing the same thing. And that's not to say that I think that it's all some sort of spiritual phenomenon or that it's all extraterrestrial. I think that at the end of the day, it's probably going to be a lot more mysterious and I think it's going to be weirder than we can imagine if we can ever get an answer.
Well, I'm with you on that. Maybe it is something, the same phenomena appearing to different people in different forms at different times.
Mm-hmm. And I think appearing to different people in different forms at different times implies that there is that the witness has some sort of role in the play in how this is perceived.
Well, you know, the other possibility is that it all comes from the same place, even though it's different stuff, and the manner in which it gets here, it whatever it uses to pierce the psychic veil or whatever, is what creates the smell.
That is a possibility. Kiel did bring this up, that perhaps a large discharge of energy could manifest a certain smell. I looked into this when I was looking into, you know, sort of the way that UFOs might enter, if you take a dimensional hypothesis, the way that they might enter our particular reality. And theoretically, an immense amount of energy being discharged would be able to sort of strip sulfur from the environment. But we're talking about the amount of energy that would be equivalent to the Large Hadron Collider. So while that's not out of the realm of possibility for, you know, an advanced extraterrestrial civilization, it seems like one of the lesser likely explanations to me personally.
Let's talk about alien abduction cases, because, you know, I hadn't even thought about smells. And I think probably a lot of folks who study UFOs and these kind of encounters, they don't think about the smell aspect of it. But as you note in the book, there are a lot of strong smells, odors associated with famous cases that we tend to overlook. For example, some of the abductees who are taken on board craft report similar smells, although some of the language they use to describe it is vague.
They do, and that's one of the problems that you run into, is that we sometimes have a difficulty in describing smells. It's called a tip of the nose phenomenon, is what smell researchers call it. But there is a consistency, a vague overarching consistency in the sort of odors that people notice. One of the most common smells that abductees notice is ozone. Another common one, obviously, is sulfur. Although you see that in abductions, you see it a little bit less common than you do in terms of people who are being abducted or outside of a craft. There was a 1994 MUFON study that claimed that over 20% of abductees would describe the smell of their own hair burning in certain abduction encounters, which is definitely an unsettling possibility.
Musty or musky, you had said a couple of cases, maybe Travis Walton, where people are actually on board the craft and they report what it smells like.
Yes, they're already smelled of must and musk, which is sort of a whole other can of worms we can get into in terms of how people describe that. But it was Travis Walton did describe the sort of damp, musty smell, and you'll find that throughout literature. Famously, Whitley Strieber described initially his captors as smelling like cinnamon and cardboard. And that's become another one of these minor motifs that people will often talk about, or the fact that sometimes these entities do smell like cinnamon or cardboard. Interestingly enough, I found a case from the late 1800s of a fairy that appeared in the countryside that smelled like burning paper, which is another way that Whitley described some of his encounters later. Whitley also described the smell of cheddar cheese, which is sort of out of that cardboard paper categorization, but you know, I think a lot of his work, so I have to sort of look into that as well.
We'll come back to Whitley in a second. Of those who are on board and report some sort of a smell, is there enough commonality to say that's what it smells like?
Well, it depends. I mean, so it, generally speaking, it's not enough of a common description in terms of where people encounter this during abduction. So people outside the craft might smell one thing, people being abducted might smell another thing, and people inside the craft might recall something entirely different.
I know you raised the point in the book about how, you know, some of these abductees are talking about being in underground facilities, which would explain some of the smells, the earthy sort of a smell.
Yeah, you do find some people talking about an earthy smell or like a smell that's sort of like an attic combined with earth, which again sort of brings up that sort of musty smell quality as well, musty, dusty, moldy smell.
Back to Whitley for a second. You sort of take him to task a little bit and then give him an out in that his description of certain smells changes over time. And you make the point that memory and smell are locked in, that it shouldn't change at all.
Right. So I self-described as something of a Whitley Strieber apologist. I think that, and to the gentleman, I think that he is continuing and continues to struggle for ways to describe it. But there is a bit of a problem in some of the, in this changing description, because I mentioned earlier, even in communion, you see, I believe, three different smell descriptions appear. The first time is because he's actually asking for the entity to prove to him that it's real, and he uses smell as a way to have it proved to him. And it smells like cinnamon and cardboard. Later, he describes recalling a musty cheese sort of smell. And again, later, he invokes this idea of burning paper or burning cardboard. So the possibilities we have to look at are several. So either A, it's complete fabrication, which I don't think.
No.
B, there is evidence to suggest that smells retrieved under hypnotic regression are very unreliable, simply because human beings don't have the ability to generate a scent picture as well in their mind's eye, even though some people claim to be able to.
Or maybe it's just an evolving explanation or description by Whitley. Josh, sorry to cut you off there. That song tells us we're going into the break. In a moment, we'll come back and take your calls, comments, questions from my guest, Joshua Cutchin, author of The Brimstone Deceit. Donovan from 1965 takes us into the break. Well, here you go. The ultimate bad smell. It's not only a skunk, it's a dead skunk, and it's in the road. That's Loudon Wainwright, Dead Skunk, a song from 1972 that still makes me laugh every time I hear it. We're talking with Joshua Cutchin about his new book, The Brimstone Deceit, and we'll get to as many of your calls, questions, and comments as we can in this next segment, our final segment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we have a lot of ground we still haven't covered. Werewolves, dogmen, the smell of fairies, and other mythical or real beings. But we're going to take some phone calls. Maybe we'll get back to those in a little bit. East of the Rockies, Virginia. Hi, Virginia. You're on with Joshua Cutchin.
Yes, good morning. Enjoying it. Yesterday I was watching PBS and they had a segment about old homes of Scotland. And in the Dumfries house, people noticed in one of the bedrooms the smell of urine, as though that's probably where the people went if they were getting ready to die. And they even knocked down part of the wall to remodel and everything, and it was still there. So it was kind of weird. But there is a cat in Rhode Island that makes the rounds with the doctors, and if the doctor sees the cat go up to a certain patient and curl up, that patient is the one that's going to die next. And it's strange. But a good doctor years ago could walk into an invalid's room and tell what disease they had, whether it was scarlet fever or whooping cough or typhoid fever. So I really believe in it. My mother used to visit an elderly woman before the war, and I could smell the clinging smell of cancer when my mother would come home until she took her clothes off and changed. So
yeah, that's interesting, Virginia, because Josh makes the point in the book about a smell of the smell of cancer, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, those are all excellent points. There's actually a famous anecdote where Freud's dog stopped playing with him because it could actually smell cancer towards the end of his life. But there are also tales of physicians, as you mentioned, who have been able to walk into even a house and be able to tell from the smell that what the patient has. So those are all excellent points. It's interesting the smell of ammonia, because ammonia is one of the sort of common outliers that I found in this study, that sort of a urine smell. It's common to not only UFO encounters, but also Sasquatch encounters as well.
Yeah, the idea of detecting disease using dogs or cats or something, it raises some interesting possibilities about how animals might be an early warning system. I don't know if that's that early, whether by the time they smell it, it's too late. But Virginia, thank you for that call. On our international line, Jeremy in Ontario, Canada. Hi, Jeremy.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. First-time caller, and it's a great honor to be on the show.
Yeah, welcome to the program.
Thank you. 21 years, I've been a licensed Ontario funeral director and embalmer, as well as I have assisted in numerous suicides and worked with the coroner's office. So, obviously, I am rather familiar with this cell of death with regards to humans. There's that putrefaction and, of course, the decomposition that is just natural process that happens. I think what's really interesting, though, is our olfactory system in our brain that processes our senses, especially smell, is so underdeveloped. And you touched on how it can be, you know, there's people that have a little bit better or greater range with that, and they're more advanced. And I believe that you can work on that. And, for instance, I know people that have lost their sight for, so that they can't see. However, they can hear you from 2 miles away or something. You know what I mean? One thing I also found was it was never sight, smells, those sorts of things that really bother you with the difficult things sometimes that you witness. It's more the circumstances. But I have found that the smell actually from a disease or when someone hasn't been seen for or discovered for a period of time, it actually stays with you. And I don't know how else to describe this, but a couple days later...
Stays with you in a way, not necessarily clinging to your clothes, but stays in your mind or in your senses?
You can taste it. You can taste it. You cough or you put something and all of a sudden it's there. I don't know if that makes sense to you, where you clear your throat and it just gets in your sinuses. However, that's just, you know, a normal thing. Also, being involved with the supernatural, specifically with exorcism and demonic possession, having witnessed one, there is an odor that I cannot explain other than just completely, what I experienced was completely vile, and that was emanating from the individual. And it ceased once the person was liberated, but it was absolutely putrid.
Jeremy, let's let Joshua weigh in here on what we've heard from you so far. Joshua?
Yeah, I definitely found interesting the idea of the smell sort of staying with you and sort of clinging to you. I found plenty of stories of tales where Sasquatch smells or ghost smells or UFO smells would cling to someone for a while physically. But sometimes I wonder if a similar thing doesn't happen with that sort of staying in your nose sort of quality. Because as you did mention, there is a strong connection between smell and taste. There really are two different sides of the same sensory coin. So I found that really interesting. It's a really interesting point.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. That was interesting stuff. We're going to go to Jeff in Culver City. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, George and Mr. Cutchin? Could these sulfuric smells be emanating from people who are already in the realms of hell and that may be trying to communicate with those of us who are not yet there? Because I ask this because I believe the dead do live on and survive and operate in some type of parallel dimension where they can interact and converse with us in our reality now. But obviously not everyone can do this and everyone can't see them. But however, they still exist. The same way as when they left. Nothing changed. On this Monday, on Channel 2 News, CBS 11 o'clock, the investigative reporter would do a segment on a young Asian woman who mysteriously died at the Hotel Cecil in downtown Los Angeles. She was found stuffed inside a water tank on the roof of that hotel. And mysteriously, two films were made before this happened to her and a remake afterwards, one in Japan and one and the other in Seattle, Washington. My question is this, Mr. Cutchins, do you believe that the young woman has found a way to communicate to someone, with the Channel 2 News Network, to get them to find out what really happened to her and is unrelenting in that pursuit? And I'll take the answer off there.
I think her name is Alyssa Kim, maybe?
Alyssa Lam, was that it?
Alyssa Lam, that's it, yes. Yeah.
So was the question specifically about communicating through smell or just in general?
Yeah, I think he's wondering if people who are dead are using that as a way to communicate, or people who are almost dead use it as a way to communicate.
I think that the evidence bears out that that is a distinct possibility. I mean, if you look at the sort of encounters that people have, the sort of post-mortem encounters of loved ones, oftentimes they will be of a scent variety. What you have to be careful with is to make sure that you aren't smelling someone's scent on old clothing or something, because I think we've all had loved ones pass away and we found an item that they've worn or something years and years later, and it still smelled like them. But I think that perhaps this might be a subtler way of the dead communicating with us. I absolutely do.
We'll try a wild card line. Marion in Iowa. Good morning, Marion.
Thanks for the great show and taking my call.
From
my understanding, and I don't know if you've heard this, but aliens are often compared to reptilians a lot, and reptilians, frogs, amphibians. I understood that the way they get their nourishment and also then the opposite, the way they excrete afterwards, is through their skin because they don't have inner workings, like we do, intestines and whatnot. So that's where I understand the smell comes from. And I don't want to be rude, but I did want to mention a lot lately. I have been reading, I mentioned about reptilians and all this. I don't know how you feel about our government, but I've heard they call like Hillary and Bill and all them reptilians, and they're aliens, they think. And a lot lately, I've been reading about people complaining about Hillary smelling. So I'm wondering if you know anything about that or you have any thoughts on that.
Well, I can tell you that it's election season. It's campaign season.
Would want to, you know, trash her, of course. But
maybe Josh can address the idea about reptilians, amphibians, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I do believe I actually heard a clip that she was talking about. I believe it was on the Alex Jones show where he mentioned that Hillary and Obama supposedly smell like sulfur. I don't personally ascribe to a lot of reptilian conspiracies. Having said that, I think that there is a germ of truth there. What's interesting to me is that if you look at the ways that reptiles operate, reptiles actually do have a musky sort of musty, nasty, sort of wet, doggish smell. I mean, if you've ever been in a reptile pet store, you'll definitely smell that. Regarding the idea of an entity consuming through its skin and excreting through its skin, a lot of the literature and abduction lore does bear that out, the idea that these aliens don't have any sort of real waste orifices. And theoretically, that could account for some of the smell that you encounter in some of these cases.
We're going to go to Teresa in Honolulu, Hawaii. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Jeff. Love Coast to Coast. Thanks for having me on. I work in the emergency room out here, and I'm lucky enough to be able to do CPR on people and bring people back to life, but I've had instances where, you know, people don't make it, and oftentimes there's a light odor in the room, but it's not a bad smell. It's a smell of almost like cleanliness of letting go.
Really?
It's kind of like a soapy smell. It's not bad. You know, I have listened to the sulfur smell and the brimstone smell or whatever. When I was younger, I was always taught that was a smell of healing, you know, like the hot springs that you go to and things like that. So could it just be, you know, the way people are raised and what they're taught,
yeah,
compared to the way it makes you feel?
Josh?
Yeah, no, that's a strong component of the way that we perceive things. I mean, if you look at certain indigenous people, I mean, the things that they live with on a day-to-day basis and are very much used to in terms of smelling have completely different connotations for us. I find really interesting your mention about the cleanliness smell. It's been shown that in some exorcisms, following the exorcism, a smell of ozone will be noted. And ozone, of course, is used and has a lot of industrial applications as a disinfectant. So I wonder if perhaps there might not be an ozone smell. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the smell of ozone or not, but it's often been described as sort of clean and almost peppery.
I can't remember where it is in the book, Josh, but I remember it mentioning a soap smell. And I don't remember what the context was, but what Teresa was saying there about being around people who die and smelling that would be a really interesting line of inquiry for you.
Absolutely.
Let's try east of the Rockies, Patsy in Tennessee. Hi, Patsy.
Hi. Yes, I just have a couple of questions. During some really major UFO experiences that my family and I had together, we could smell a smell that smelled like the house, the wiring was messed up in the house. It was like a burning of wires. As a matter of fact, we even called the fire department several times. And directly after we had these experiences, I would go outside and you just could feel the presence of like an angelic presence and smell like what is called a box elder bush smell. I don't know if anyone has ever smelled one, but for those people that have, it has sort of like a cinnamon smell. And if anyone had ever reported that, I just wondered. And thank you very much. I'll take my answer off there.
Thank you, Patsy. Well, cinnamon smell certainly comes up.
It does. You'll find cinnamon smells in a variety of cases, as we had talked about, you know, Struber's encounters. But that was actually a perfect segue from the last question, how we talked about ozone a little bit. You know, ozone is one of those things that does suffer from that tip of the nose phenomenon. A lot of times people have smelled it, and they search for ways to describe it. And it sounds like that's something very akin to what she was experiencing, that sort of smell of wires burning out is the way that a lot of people would describe ozone.
We're going to try Aisha in the Bronx. who has a smell story of her own. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Hello, you can hear me?
Yeah, we can, yeah. Why don't you tell us what's on your mind?
Okay, yeah. This happened to me like about a year ago, and I was sleeping in my living room. All of a sudden, I'm smelling like a strong perfume, like cologne. And I'm thinking, I don't know, it was my neighbor from the door. Maybe he had his door open, but it was closed. And I was smelling like a strong. My question is, am I being tricked? Am I being tricked by some type of malevolent being from some other dimension? Or some too, like the other guest was saying that he was hearing tapping noises or something. I'm hearing the same tapping noises in my bedroom. Like one time I was sleeping and then I felt something touch my hand. And when I woke up, there was nothing there. And I was also getting those, you know, flying dreams flying over the building. That too, I had that. And then also when I sleep, I felt somebody trying to grab me, but when I woke up, they weren't there. And also I'm hearing voices when I'm sleeping. So is this some type of entity or something?
Wow, you got a lot going on there. Josh, you want to offer an opinion? I guess first on the perfume stuff. Now, there could be other explanations for it, prosaic explanations, but I mean, that perfume thing does pop up in some of the cases you explore in the book.
Right. So the good news is, if these things are linked, the smell and all the other sensations, if they're linked, I have found probably less than 10 encounters where something smelled pleasant and was evil or was malignant. For the most part, it's that sort of idea that the nose can give you some sort of insight into the true nature of a presence or an entity. If this is something demonic that smells pleasant, like perfume or cologne, it would be definitely an outlier. So I think you should find some solace in that. Having said that, I don't think, if it really does bother you, I think the idea of perhaps going out and getting some frankincense or some dragon's blood incense wouldn't be out of the question. And, you know, at the end of the day, even if it doesn't work, your house smells better.
Okay. Thanks to all of our callers. Appreciate it. Those are some good questions. Josh Cutchin, I really enjoyed the book. It's called The Brimstone Deceit. I think people should add it to their library. It's good work.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
Keep us in mind for whatever you got coming down the pipeline.
Oh, I absolutely will. I don't have anything planned yet, but we'll see what happens.
All right, appreciate it, Joshua Cutchin. And again, the book is called The Brimstone Deceit. Thanks also to my earlier guest John Ventry, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Juan Velasquez tonight, Donna Walker, our webmaster Greg Bishop, operations manager Dan Galati, and our producer Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next month. Couple of weeks. Happy Halloween, everyone.